I can have your attention for just an hour or so. I'm sort of amazed because I realize that many of the people who were here yesterday were people who left on the bus this noon, and so apparently some of you are filling in their chairs and so forth. So let me ask, how many of you are new with me today? How many? About half of you are. Welcome. Also, for those of you who were here yesterday, being a college professor, I know one thing, and that has to do with people's listening skills. And it turns out, at least from the research, that when people are listening for a 10-minute period, after that 10-minute period is over, they've lost already 50% of everything that's been said. And so, for that reason, I thought I would, for the new people, I thought I'd go back and sort of review some of the things I was talking about yesterday, and also that I would do that for the people who were here, just in case you got it in the wrong 50% and didn't remember some of the things I was talking about. So, one of the things I did share with you yesterday, the new people wouldn't know, my name's John Watkins. I teach at Ferris State College in Big Rapids, Michigan. In terms of the things that we were talking about yesterday, for those of you who are new, I had a title up there that said, "It Ain't Healthy to Be Normal." And I'd like to go through just very briefly some of the points that I was making at that point. I won't ask, you know, have a quiz today for the rest of you. One of the things that it meant when I said it ain't healthy to be normal is that right now there has been a virtual flood into therapy. And I'm talking now here about mental emotional therapy. We have a situation right now where report that was put out last year indicated that about 1 in 7 of our entire national population can be described as being in the hardcore emotionally ill. Another study indicates that in a study done in New York, only 18% of 175,000 people, 18% of them, 1 in 6, were free of symptoms of mental illness or emotional illness. So these are, if you will, what we would call the really healthy people. There was another group now, and this has nothing to do with studies. All you have to do is do a little bit of math. Take a look at that as a continuum from one end to the other, and you'll realize that there are about 67% of us who are in the mid-range. Now keep in mind then, what we're talking about is that we are not the healthy ones. We are the people who have some symptoms, some things that are bothering us, but we're not going into therapy, you know, or we're not in that hardcore. Now, right now, mental illness has been equated with communication illness. Now, I'm not talking here about some of these that can be described as endogenous illnesses, the ones that come from inside you, but I'm talking about the ones that are can be communicationally, I suppose, I hate to say programmed, but at least there are the effects of communication. And so what I was talking about yesterday is a tremendous need that we have in this country to build a dam, a preventative dam. And to me, that dam, well, recognizing that it's not normal to be healthy in America, then that dam is the dam of communication. And it's the communication that goes on in the family. One of the things I talked about yesterday, I'd like to remind you of, I think it's worth repeating, and that is that in a Gallup poll done in 1980 on the American family, the results of that poll, I'm going to ask you, those of you who were here yesterday, where do we go first when we have a family problem? We go to another family member. Where do we go second? We go to our friends. Hey, you're going on for A's, I'll tell you. How about, where do we go third? All right, we go to the Bible. Typically, that's where we go. Where do we go fourth? All right, we go to a clergy, a person in the clergy. All right, where do we go fifth?
Lawyer.
To the doctor, to the family doctor, generally speaking. All right, lawyer doesn't come up for a while. How about sixth? Where then? Where? Okay, other books. And this is why the self-help market is as big as it is right now, because we're going to them now for assistance. Where do we go seventh? All right, to the professional therapist. In other words, we really don't want to go to that person, but we go to that person only after the others have failed. And when that person fails us, where do we go?
Lawyer.
we go to our attorneys. And at that point, we're probably dissolving our relationships. So what I was indicating yesterday was, in order to build this dam of communication, we have to recognize, or we have to learn, that love is a verb. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And to do that, I'm going to be, for those of you who don't have paper with you, I'm going to ask my wife, if you'll just distribute paper around. You all recognize her from her picture yesterday?
Yeah.
The four questions I'd like you to answer start off with this one. How do you like that? What is communication to you? The second question is, why do you communicate? Why do you do it? Third question is, how do you communicate? And the last question is, when do you communicate? Now, the way you answer those questions will later on tell you a lot about the way you look at your relationships with other people. On the one hand, most of us, or many of you, may have been saying, hey, those are dumb questions. Everybody knows. And we make that assumption that everybody knows. And yet the way we look on communication and how we do it is going to determine a lot about our relationships. Several years ago, in fact, probably about 6 or 7 years anyway, I did my doctoral study on a program that many of you may be acquainted with. There's a program that is known as Marriage Encounter. How many of you have been on Marriage Encounter? Okay, so a number of you know what I'm talking about. For those of you who are not acquainted with Marriage Encounter, let me tell you that it is an enrichment program for marriages. It's not a therapy program. It's a program that was started originally in Spain around 1962 by a Catholic priest who recognized that many of the children in his parish who were delinquent children were coming from homes in which the kids were describing their parents as having marital problems. And so Father Calvo, to come to grips with that, designed a program initially for the parents in his parish and to help those marriages that were already good, help them to become better, help them hopefully to become great. Now, the purpose of my study for Marriage Encounter was to find out how those couples going on a Marriage Encounter weekend related with one another, how much of an effect did it have on the couples' relationships involved. In other words, what I was being asked to do was measure the love relationships of those couples beforehand and afterward. Now, I'd like to have you take a look at some slides here. As you look at that couple, how would you measure the love relationship between those two people? Now, I think you can say as you look at that slide, hey, apparently they really have a neat relationship. Or how would you take a look at that couple and measure their relationship? I mean, how do you put that into some sort of quantifiable terms? Or, this is one of my favorite pictures, I love this. That is a couple. And it says so much. And how on earth do you ever get that quantified? How on earth do you ever get that measured? Now, see, for me, the problem was that in terms of the communication models that are out there, the way we look at communication, there weren't any that really dealt with human relationships. They dealt with other things, but not human relationships. And you see, we have kind of a problem in that we as human beings are often dependent on analogies for learning about other things. And see, for example, I'm in a position where I, you know, can learn to run a boat like that by analogizing it to the way I could drive a car. Now, I don't know if you are thinking for a moment that this is our car. Let me assure you that it is not. And that is not our home. College professors don't make that kind of money. But at least the point of the analogy, I think, is clear. Also, I was able to learn how to love this woman. Same woman as that one back there. I should clarify that point. But I was able to learn to love her because for the early years of my life and since then, I had learned to love this woman, who happens to be my mom. Now, so we learn by way of analogy. But I want you to think about the kinds of analogies that we have when we think in terms of communication. And I want to ask that question of you again, what is communication to you? And I'm going to talk about some analogies. I'd like you to look at that definition or think of that definition, the words you used as you frame that definition. In 1949, Shannon and Weaver were a couple of gentlemen who came up with a neat way of describing how telephones work. And they said, you know, that we had a system in which there was an information source, a transmitter, a noise source, a receiver, and all of that. And what I need to let you know is that in my field of speech communication, when this model came out, we were delighted to find out about it. Because when I was an undergraduate, I can remember my department chairman telling me that there had just been a new study out talking about how well the various departments or the various academic areas stood up against one another. And in that ranking, in terms of difficulty of content and all of that, speech communication did not come out last. It came out second to the last. And the only one that was below us was physical education. That was the least of the academic areas. We were second to the least. And somewhere in there was the area of psychology, too. And in the area of psychology and the area of speech communication, were absolutely delighted to see a model of communication come out like this. And we jumped on it so that we could make our fields look very academic. And that was just really very special. Now, by adopting this kind of a model and talking about transmitters and receivers and noise and information and all of that sort of thing, one of the things involved there was we quit looking at the way human beings communicate. And we started taking a look at the way machines did it. And then when the technology went from telephones to computers and servo systems, what did we do? We came out with other really neat machine models. We came out with one like that. Now we were concerned with messages going in circles with feedback and all of that sort of stuff. We were concerned with encoding and decoding. We had messages going around with interpreters and all of that. That's what the machines did, so that's what we as humans did. By the same token, you know, human beings were no longer talking with one another. We were now interfacing. So all of this was going on, the machine area. And I'd like to show you how much that kind of communication language has pervaded the way we talk about communication. I don't know what you have on your papers, but I can pretty well guess it could very easily include any of the terms that I've been talking about. Now, there is a town about 11 miles away from Big Rapids, our community. And in that town is a firm called Nartron. Now, I recognize that it's probably a little bit difficult to read that, particularly for most of you at a distance. But what this is an advertisement that I've seen in our local paper several times. Notice that they are advertising for an executive secretary, a secretary, and other positions. But what you may not be able to realize is what that secretary position is all about. Because what they want in an executive secretary position is one, a secretary who has outstanding interpersonal communication skills to interface with the top corporate executive. Now, this ad has run several times, and I suppose that may be that they hired a secretary in the first place that wouldn't interface. I don't know. Now, in April, I had the opportunity to speak to a group of high school students. And this was up at Cadillac, Michigan. And when I went up there, or after I had spoken, I know you can't read this, but I'd like to share it with you. It says, "We would personally like to thank you for the fine presentation you gave for Career Day. Your input was greatly appreciated." Now, I want you to know that all I wanted to do was talk with those kids. I didn't want to do any inputting at all. Just talk with those kids. But again, notice what's happened. In terms of another area here, my wife and I have been involved in home hospice. And we were on the initial board of home hospice. And they, after our first year of operation, we felt really good, because people were talking that our organization was ready to go online. Now, think of all the ways that we have talked about mechanically the way humans communicate. I think sort of the coup de grace, the whole thing for me, came when this advertisement came. They're advertising speech communication books. And notice what they're saying. They're saying, "We're sending..." Got to get those words in. "Good news about communication. You're receiving information through 3 proven transmitters." Down at the bottom, you can't read it, but it's almost a contradiction in terms, because one of the books being advertised is "Each Other, a Sensitive Introduction to Interpersonal Communication." So I think you can see what I'm talking about in terms of the analogies here. And I'd like to have you take a look. You've had that first question of what is communication to you. One of the things I want to stress for you is whatever you put down there, you're absolutely right. I have no reason to believe that you would lie on a question like that of what is it to you. I'm sure you told me what it was to you or wrote it down there. But the important thing is, look at that analogy. Look at that next question that you have. Why do you communicate? Because in that question, most of my students, most of the people I talk with, wind up saying, I talk to get my point across. Or I talk to get somebody to do something. In other words, their intent, as they're thinking about it, communication occurs when they intend for it to occur. It doesn't occur at any other time. And the result of this is a myth that we've created. We've created an idea that some people are more ineffective communicators than others are. And what you need to realize is that all of us are always effective in communication. We very frequently don't get the effects that we wish we did, but we are nevertheless being effective. But when we move away from the machine analogies, this is one thing that happens. And we also get the idea that communication breaks down. Communication never breaks down. The only time it started breaking down was when we started comparing it to equipment that breaks down. Human communication is going on all the time. You're aware of that. Then take a look at that question, how you answered, how do you communicate? Did you put down something like voice, by gestures, by movement, and all of those approaches? Notice what you're doing again with the analogy. We get back to the idea of sending and receiving, don't we? And it omits the fact that we are communicating also as we are seeing, as we are observing, as we are listening, as we are touching, as we are smelling, that we, on that end of it, are communicating. In other words, what's involved here is that we communicate by our experiences. Whatever we experience is communicating with us. And most of us don't think about that because of the machines. I'd like you to do something. I'd like you to take that piece of paper, and I would like you to fold it for me. And on it, I'd like you to print your mother's name. Print in large letters your mother's name. Like so. Okay. All right, got it done? Okay, now I'd like to have you take that piece of paper, hold it out in front of you like this. And then I'd like to have you take your pen or your pencil. Got to get a different one out here.
There it is.
Okay. Take your pen or pencil and hold it out in front of you too. And now I'd like to have you stab your mother's name. Somebody was getting violent. Now, notice what we had here. A bunch of screwy little lines on a piece of paper. But where was the meaning of all of that?
In your head.
It came in the idea of the experiencing of your mom, didn't it? That made it very difficult for us to react. It was the whole emotional content of that that made it difficult. Now, let me show you. That's your mother's name? Olga? Didn't bother me a bit. And the reason it didn't is that I've never experienced Olga as he has experienced Olga. And yet it's a very totally different dimension, isn't it, than machine communication is all about. Now, I'd like to give you one other example. I don't know if you can do it on that same piece of paper. Anyway, I'd like to have you draw a picture of a scene that took place this morning. No, it wasn't this morning. It was before we left. Has to be. Anyway, my dog put her feet on my chest. I'd like to have you draw me a picture of that, if you would. You can use stick figures. I'd like to have you draw me a picture of that. My dog put her feet on my chest. On my chest. That's all the information I'm giving you. All right, now, how many of you, if you haven't finished that picture already, you at least know what you were going to do? How many of you have drawn that as a big dog with her feet, hind feet on the ground, and her feet up on my chest? How many of you had it that way? Okay, a number of you did. How many of you had it as a small dog? And maybe you're holding in your hands or whatever, and her feet were on my chest. How many of you had that one? How many of you had me reclined on the floor or in bed with the dog with her feet on my chest? Okay. Great many of you did. Okay. How many of you had it as it happened with my dog with her feet on my chest of drawers? So there were three of you. Now at that point, we shared meaning, right? My communication was effective with these people. Was it effective with the rest of you? Sure it was. It didn't break down. You got a meaning, you got a message out of that. It may not have been the one that I intended, but at least you got the message. Now, all I'm saying here is one last thing for you to be aware of. That we have the idea from our machine analogies. What do machines do? You know, you go up to a machine and what do? You turn it on, right? And when you're through with it, you turn it off. Now that's the idea that a lot of people have about communication too, isn't it? You turn it on, you turn it off, because that's the way machines work. And we have that analogy. That's the wife who says, "I'm not talking with you anymore." Or the husband who says, "I don't want to talk about it. I'm through. I don't want to." No. And all of a sudden, communication stops? No. We're communicating 100% of the time. Every minute we're alive and awake, we're communicating. So, but again, the machine analogies have been disadvantageous. Well, anyway, let's talk about love being a verb, because that's what we're involved here. What I realized in terms of the marriage encounter study was that the machine analogies, first of all, were not true, and secondly, they would not work. And how do you measure love? And I got very interested in how I reacted to love. And I thought, the only way I can, well, let me give that next slide up here because I like it. Obviously, that, if you can see it, the machine with the printout doing psychoanalysis or whatever, you know, it just doesn't fit. But what does fit is when I take a look at my relationship with my wife, and that's what I was doing before. And I thought, what is it like? How do I feel in my relationship with her? And I realized that there were some times when I felt loved, and there were some times that I felt unloved. And that went on in our relationship. I felt loved when she touched me and when she listened to me. Those were neat times. But I also felt unloved when she felt, you know, when I felt put off at a distance. And that really bothered me. Then there were other times. There were times that I felt loving toward her. And those were the times that maybe we might just be sitting in a living room or in the kitchen or somewhere, and I'd say, you know, honey, I sure do love you. She'd smile. But there were also the times when I felt very unloving toward her. And these were the times when I knew that I was doing something that would intentionally, that would hurt her, or I'd make her feel stupid. And that was pretty unloving. But there were other times too, and these were the times when I felt lovable. And these may be the times when things have been going well in my classes and I felt really neat and very special. But there are times when I also felt unlovable, where maybe things hadn't gone well in our relationship for a while, and I thought, something wrong with me. Okay? Now, recognizing all of that, I also realized that there were the times when, I hope you can see it over here, when I felt loved, and as I felt loved, I felt more lovable. Have you thought about it? Sure. When you feel loved by somebody else, that makes you feel lovable. And it's that situation, you've probably seen that on many occasions, of you're nobody till somebody loves you. And I knew that. But there's also another side of that too, another poster I like very much, is this little puppy who says, you know, we are lovable, Lord, because you love us. And it made me think of the words of Paul as he was saying, you know, we are able to love because God first loved us, or Christ first loved us. I don't remember the exact wording of it, but I think the point was there. There was also another dimension of it too, and that was that as I felt loved, I guess I'm going to block it here for people. As I felt loved, I felt more lovable. But at the same time, that meant as I felt lovable, I felt more loving toward my wife. And that's a common situation, isn't it? How many times have you heard that statement? It's a lot in pop psychology and so forth now, where we have the idea that you have to love yourself before you can love other people. And I'd like to modify that a little bit, because there's something negative about that. I think you have to see yourself as lovable. Not that you have to love yourself, but that you have to see yourself as lovable before you can love other people. Now, with that in mind, I also realized that if this were a model of the way I loved, then my wife had the mirror image of that model, didn't she? Because she would feel loved, she would feel loving, or lovable, and then she would feel loving. And so, as I thought about all those six different positions, how on earth do you ever measure love between people? And how do you measure? Well, you can't measure the love. I finally concluded that. What you can do is you can measure how people communicate their love to one another. And I'd like you to think about the people that you love at this point, and how have you communicated that love to those other people? One of the things that's sort of interesting is that word communication, whatever you put down as your definition of it or description of it, that word communication means in the Latin shared meaning. It's kind of neat, isn't it?